Session number 12394, Jim Gilbert, Reel 6.
Jim Gilbert, Reel 6.
So the people who were against the Persian Gulf War were portrayed as either bad Americans or cowards. And I knew these people, and they were neither. One of the really strong points is that our Constitution is being trampled, and if anybody is acting on behalf of freedom, it's us, you know, trying to evoke some consciousness of what's going on. And so I decided, I really didn't want to do this, but in an effort to gain credibility and to thwart this casual dismissal of anybody that's opposed to the war, I put on my uniform. And it was a way to say that you can't challenge my patriotism, and you can't challenge my courage. I'm not doing this because I'm a bad American. I'm doing this because what we're doing is wrong. The question that I keep asking, and I continue to ask, is where is the justice in killing innocent men, women, and children who have no say-so in who their leaders are and no input in the policies of their nations? And to this day, we continue through our denying them of certain foodstuffs, medical supplies, and the material they need to rebuild the infrastructure for sewage, and you know, there's famine. And we are viciously and brutally killing innocent, powerless victims. That's not just. And I'm ashamed of us. And yet, I think if we understood this, we would all be ashamed of us. But somehow the message gets muted. It's like there's a defensive. I'm not attacking people for supporting the troops. You know? So I was involved in various rallies. I felt honored that when the bombing started, you just don't kill people to get what you want. I mean, it's just stupid. How do we expect the Iraqi people to embrace United States citizens? Someone the other day, I was talking about this, and they said, well, you know, we're starving them, and this is wrong. And he said, yeah, but you know, they'd want to do the very same things to us. And it's like, well, you know, if I was in their shoes, I probably would too. What do we expect from them? We've bombed their country, and you know, beyond the physical deaths, the emotional carnage of you know, battle fatigue, I mean, just the terrorism of this. And what about, you see, if we want to talk about a just war, the six precepts of a just war, proportionality is one, and that the war is, in fact, a last resort. Clearly, this war, we didn't do anything to try to intervene before the fact. We, if you really evaluate it honestly, this war was, it was orchestrated. And it was made to happen. I don't know precisely the reasons. I've never felt that it was motivated by oil as the primary. I felt that it, because there were other ways to secure oil, there were other ways to get Saddam Hussein out. We didn't have to go fight a war to do that. So the only two things that I'm aware of that necessitate a war is the destruction of Iraq's military or the assassination of Saddam Hussein. And I'm not sure the assassination of Hussein requires war. But we didn't need to do this.
How did it change things when you put your uniform on? You know, did you find that you were then not abused to the same extent?
I was abused in a different way by some. I remember walking, and some guy just came along and just looked at me, and he singled me out, you know, and just called me an asshole. Which, I mean, you see, another part of this, the American people somewhere between 80 and 90% of the American people supported the war. I know 80 to 90% of the American people are not bad. They're not interested in harming others. There was some issue that had to do with patriotism, possibly a backlash to Vietnam and maybe to Korea, and not feeling good about the wars that we fought more recently from World War II. Some need maybe to be the good guys again. You know, we tried to be the good guys in Vietnam, and history showed us that we were jerks. And we don't want to be jerks. We want to be good. And so I think that we were presented with an opportunity to get back on the white horse and go liberate somebody and have done the good things and the right things for the world. Because, again, my birthright, that was our role internationally. We screwed it up in Vietnam, and here was a chance to undo the bads and redo some good things. See, and I think we didn't want to know any more than that. We don't want to know who's dying. We want to feel good about what we're doing. And that's a legitimate need, all right? It's just that we're doing it in an irresponsible, avoidance, sick kind of way. We're a sick society. We aren't able to look at truth without feeling assaulted, you see? And I would love to see America say, gosh, you know, we got to stop this. We need to send food. I mean, there's a brutality in our own cities now that wasn't evidenced 2 years ago. The respect for life of American to American has diminished. And I don't think it's disconnected to the hour by hour, day by day, constant pumping in of the war into our homes, but a very selected view of the war. Everything that was shown here was the power of the United States military, planes taking off, planes coming back triumphantly, the fear of a Scud attack. But we didn't see a lot of carnage, one hit. But we apparently killed hundreds of thousands of people, you know. And proportionality. When I was trained, we were trained to encourage people to surrender. We were taught how to take care of prisoners of war. A rocket grenade is not as powerful as a hand grenade. And my understanding, in the very last major battle, the Iraqis were fleeing. Some scared kid, he might have been 14 years old, shoots a rocket grenade off in the direction of the American troops. And we wind up killing over 1,000 men. If we had lost that war, our commanders and leaders would probably be convicted of war crimes. The proportionality of killing 1,000 people just indiscriminately, shooting them down like animals. You know, I'm calling the road to Basra, you know, that everything that moved just killed. It's a massacre. And for a while I was trying to get people to talk about it as a massacre. You know, this wasn't a war, it was a massacre. And I think, gosh, you know, we were able to bridge the gap of the Nazi private, the German trooper, and divorce him from the politics of the situation and be able to say, well, he was on the wrong side, but he wasn't a Nazi, et cetera, et cetera. And why can't we do this? Is it simply because they're not Caucasians? Is it our racism that's at it? Why can't we see these kids conscripted with no real viable choice? They don't want to be out there fighting us. They don't want to be out there doing that. They don't want to get killed. And what are the messages we're sending them? You give up, we're hunting you down. So, of course, they're going to try to defend themselves from a slaughter. And they get slaughtered. Well, that's... I mean, I don't even know what to say about that.
Did you find, when you put your uniform on, did other veterans join you? You know, were you the only one?
I was the only one.
Because I've heard about this Veterans for War.
Okay, Veterans for Peace. It was a national organization that I had never heard of, but one man in St. Louis who also was active against the war had been a member of Veterans for Peace. And at one of the speeches I gave, he came up and gave me a brochure, and so I wrote off and joined. And we wound up having a meeting, three, and then there were four of us. And there was an article, a local columnist went and stayed in Saudi Arabia during the war and wrote a lot of articles and columns and sent back and was out of touch with what was going on. He came back and he made some real patronizing kinds of comments about the anti-war people, passé, and suggesting that we were living in the 60s and that this was kind of a leap back to the dope-smoking, hippie kinds of things and the flower children, and we were just kind of reliving some times past. And so I didn't like that, and I wrote him a letter and I explained to him that I was a vet and that the people that I know in the anti-war movement are not as he describes. They're people that are bright, sensitive, I respect them, and I would be interested in fairness if he would sit down and speak. And he did. And he wrote an article. And it was, people started coming out, talking about the killings. You see, we grow up, we learn that what we did when we were 20, 19, 21, while we did what we did out of what we thought were good reasons and good motives, we were wrong. And we mature, you know, we grow wiser. This isn't the way to solve these issues. And so people would write and call. We put a group together. And I think part of it was a way of each of us. You see, I have a lot of guilt about wanting to kill people and being so proud of being so good at it. Because it's not. I'm a kind of a Christian person. I look to Christ as an example of how I want to live. I see a lot of really positive. I worship at a Catholic church, but I'm not sure that I'm as Catholic as the traditional Catholics, you know, which is fine with me. We started learning about, I don't know if you know this, but this was a fact that was printed in the New England Medical Journal maybe a year ago, maybe less. But the I think it's the Veterans Administration now, their most current estimate of suicides among Vietnam vets is a number higher than the American soldiers killed in Vietnam. And we started getting facts about the costs of war. And in some cities, 25% of the homeless are Vietnam vets. Okay? The rate of alcoholism among Vietnam veterans is something like 4 times higher than the normal population. The rate of indigency and the suicides and all these things, it's like, well, this is a response to something. Now, is it just Vietnam or is it war? Is it, and why not in World War II? And maybe World War II, we did bad things, but we did them clearly for the right reasons and people came back and they were heroes for serving. See? When I got out of the Army, I landed in St. Louis Christmas Eve morning and I was able to get enrolled and start school in January. So there was a little period of time. I didn't have any money, so I didn't have a lot of clothes. And when I went back one day, and I was able to go full-time because I got the GI Bill, work nights. I wore my field jacket to school, and I didn't know. I'd been gone for 2 years. I didn't know much about what was going on in the United States. And I remember out of the corner of my eye, and again, you know, I still had all these skills. I mean, I was still observant and still feeling kind of, this woman came just racing at me and screaming, baby killer. And it's like, wow, you know, I never did any of that stuff. And I know guys who did, but I now understand that given the context of their lives, why they did, and I don't think that we can hold them responsible. It's real easy to be in this anesthetized, sterile kind of environment and judge. But see, to me, the judgment is made when you choose to go to war, because part and parcel of that is the atrocities. You're not going to have a war without the atrocities. And by going to war, you're accepting those atrocities. And that's where the responsibility lays. It isn't the guy doing it only. It's the society that is supporting all of this. And if you think of what it must be like to be out in the field for 30 days in a jungle, an unfriendly jungle, not knowing who your allies are, where they are, there's no lines, it's almost as though where literally kids come up with hand grenades and blow themselves up, and you're getting shot at and you're mad and you don't want to be here, and maybe the people at home don't like the war, whatever, you're mad. You're crazy, you know, you've become an animal. You have to be an animal to get by. You have to. You can't survive as a sensitive human. You can't live like that. You just cannot. You kill people. It's what you do. My friend, I won't mention him by name, the other night talking about this. He was in the Marine Corps, lost vision in his eye, shipped back to the States. He was there early, 64, so he's retired, which means he has all the benefits as though he's a retiree. Well, they didn't think it was going to be a big war, see, so people that were wounded and disabled, they put on permanent retirement, so he's got the benefits. Went back to San Diego State. People having a party outside, loud, he didn't like it. Somebody threw a bottle, threw it through his window. Been home 5 days. They didn't debrief us. So he went and got a shotgun. Walked outside, he said, I want you to leave these premises and go away. And if you don't, I'll shoot you. Okay? So one of these guys, big, drunk, you know, got to be macho, right? We got to be big, especially when we're drinking. So he starts coming up the steps, threatening. So my friend pumps the shotgun and says, you need to stop or I'll shoot you. So the guy stops, he looks at him. He kind of looks down and shrugs and starts coming up like, yeah, I dare you. And so he shoots him. And he looks at me and he says, because that's what you do. When I came back, with a group, and we were at Fort Dix. It was the day before Christmas Eve. Cold, wet, puddles, ice, mud. I didn't bring a lot of clothes because I didn't want to carry a lot of stuff to get home. I brought what I needed to turn in. We landed late because of a storm. Got to the fort about 3 in the morning, and rather than going to bed and getting up at 5, they had us just start filling out the papers. We had a formation at 6, went at 8, went, made the beds, cleaned up the barracks, and had to be back in formation at 8. And we stood in the ice. I mean puddles. I don't mean ice. It wasn't solid ice. It was wet water with ice for over an hour. I had to go get another haircut to leave. They wouldn't let me off the post until I got another short haircut. Just one more kind of dehumanizing kind of a thing. There were guys there. I was a sergeant. And there were guys that, you know, seen combat and paratroopers. They treated us like dirt. Once more, this was like the last time. Guys have been in 15 years. And it was like an old shoe. I mentioned earlier Biggins, who was a real gentleman. He was 43 years old. He went in World War II, was wounded and medically discharged from the military, but he liked it and was able to get back in the 50s. He served, he was with the AmeriCal Division in World War II, and they were Americans in Caledonia, and they basically swept the islands. Served in Korea. Served in Vietnam, okay? He had 6 months to go. He had 24 years in, and he didn't want to continue. The Army just had gotten to be bad enough that he didn't want the 6 more years, he would have gotten a full pension. But I talked to him about it. We were friends, and it was the officers. They were so poorly trained and so ignorant of what they were supposed to do and so full of being in charge, and they were getting people killed. I mentioned the lieutenant. I never finished that came to my unit from the University of Detroit. I, after time, decided that if we got sent into combat, I felt morally obligated to shoot this guy in the leg and get him out of here because he'll get us killed if I don't. That's the kind of leadership that they were pumping over, you see, and people's lives are on the line, you know, and it's no wonder it's a mess. Biggins gets orders. They want to send him back to Vietnam. 6 months. He puts in his retirement papers, and immediately they give him orders to go back to Vietnam. And they not only that, but he's going to be an American advisor to an Arvon unit, which means he's going to be one of three Americans wandering around through the jungle with a bunch of South Vietnamese regulars who are poorly trained and not real motivated to fight. And he's 43 years old. What kind of a thank you? This guy was brilliant. Really a patriot.
You were saying, weren't you, when you mentioned him, that this was your last day and there were all these...
Oh, they just treated us like dirt.
And he was there as well.
No, he wasn't there. This is just another example of how there was no thank you. The other thing is, you've been living as a combat infantryman 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And there's no debriefing, they didn't even give us a ride to the bus station. It's like, here's your stuff, here's your papers, there's the gate, and you're on your own. And there wasn't a thank you, nothing, you know? And it just, I think part of me felt, if I had volunteered for this, that might be less unacceptable. But I didn't. You all took me. You plucked me off the streets. And you made me do this. You know, you took 2 years of my life. Probably plus some other stuff. Doesn't seem befitting. So a lot of veterans are in touch with a lot of the issues about being abused by the military and being lied to by the government and the justifications for killing all these people that have evaporated and the fact that this conduct doesn't work. And, you know, we're here now to say this is not a way of resolving conflicts. This is a way of building future conflicts. You know, we're so pleased to point to Versailles, and we know all about Versailles and how it led to World War II. What's the difference? There's no difference except they're not Caucasians now in Iraq, you know? And it's just, I mean, to me, it's painfully obvious that war is counterproductive in all respects.
Do you think of yourself now, Jim, as a pacifist?
No, I do not. I'm not a pacifist because I think that there are always going to be some people who will be willing to resort to violence to get what they want. And that without some counter, I don't want to call it a threat, but force, would invade nations. And I think Saddam Hussein is one. I think George Bush is one. You know, he will use emotional violence, physical violence, military, it doesn't matter. You know, he will always opt, I shouldn't say always, but as things stand now, I would expect that he will opt for a military solution over a negotiated solution when his masculinity is at stake, when politically he needs to be seen as strong. He'll never opt for a negotiated position. I just don't believe he will. I think I don't have the answer, but I think you mentioned earlier about economics. I personally believe it's clear to me that world peace is going to be built, the underpinnings are going to be an interdependence of trade. I need you for your bread, you need me for my butter. It's like when I think of Russia destroying America, I think, you know, that's stupid. We produced so much wheat that the world ate that, I mean, the best defense we could have would be to point the missiles on ourselves and say, you do anything to us, we're blowing the bread box up. There's not going to be any food because we were the largest producer of, you know. I mean, you need us. And still today, our economic position has been eroded dramatically, but we're still an enormous market. We buy lots and lots of stuff. We produce lots of things, commodities, products. We're too important. People need us, and we need them. And when we can start, see again, there's a whole attitude about buy American that if you buy Japanese, you're supporting the Japanese country against us. And if you look at Ethiopia or Biafra or Iraq and you say, you know, these people are dirt poor. And why are they not entitled to some of the bounty of this globe? Do we have the right, because we live on this continent, to claim ownership to the resources of this continent as ours and exclude all of the other people of the world? And I think I've got to a place, I used to argue, yeah, we do, but I don't believe that anymore. There's plenty for all of us. And why isn't a poor, starving individual in an African nation entitled to a decent quality of food, clothing, and shelter? I think that's minimal. You know, well, we don't even provide that here for the poor, much less somewhere else. And our whole mindset is that these people are our enemies economically. Buy American, preserve jobs so we have more. We've already got more than enough, you know? And because if we don't have more, then they've got some, see? Well, we get trapped because it's like, how can we expect everybody to participate in the bounty? And yet we thwart their efforts to industrialize and to produce, and we put tariffs up, and we get into these wars, economic wars. And if people were to really understand the benefits of fair trade, prices drop. We can have more. We don't have to do this artificially. We can do it really. And we can work together. You know, one thing about the war is it felt like a lot of Americans pulled together. And, you know, I think that feels good. Being on a team trying to accomplish something, it feels good. There's, you know, we see, I don't know why people are the way they are, but there's something about that. And I think, you know, if we could expand that to a global sense. When I was in the military, we had weapons, we had ammunition, and we had trigger assemblies or butt plates or whatever. And the regulations did not allow the three of those to be in the same place at the same time unless you were going to a range or you were going into combat to use those things. And it was for safety. And I think, well, you know, we put a coalition together around Desert Storm. We got a world to agree that what Saddam Hussein was doing was wrong. And most of the world didn't want to fight a war, you know, and wanted to do some things economically that would have worked. It takes time. I don't want to starve the Iraqi people. I don't want to deprive them of medical supplies. And I don't want to deprive them of heating oil. But they don't need TVs and luxury items. And they'll get tired of having nothing but the basics. But at least they can live a meaningful, somewhat dignified life. And still, they'll capitulate because they want a part of the pie. Everybody does. And why not then think about a certain nation producing a certain part of a rocket and a different nation producing a warhead, and that there's some checks and balances that these things can't get into the same proximity except by some kind of UN something, you know? I'll tell you, this is a, and it blows people away, but a litmus test that I stumbled onto for a gentler, kindler nation and world and all of that is I'll believe that the United States is really committed to becoming an equal partner when they work actively to eliminate the Security Council in the United Nations and get rid of the veto power. As long as we have the veto power, we can call the shots to a large degree and dominate.
So, very briefly, are you optimistic or pessimistic when you look to the future, the immediate future?
I think I'm optimistic. We had an election in Louisiana where a former Ku Klux Klaner and a former Nazi sympathizer ran against a known crook, and these were two horrible choices. And more than 75% of the registered voters turned out and voted, given that the choices were bad. But the thing is that 29% is a big deal anymore. You know, the voter apathy is so large. And yet, I think things are getting so bad that people are going to be shaken out of their apathy. And I think that when that happens, we're going to see a system that becomes less hostile to the larger group, and that the larger population is more interested in living in harmony with other people and to not wanting war is the...
Well, Jim, thank you very much indeed, you know, for telling me about your experience in the forces and your anti-war activity as well. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I feel privileged.